Think. Frans, ek wil begin deur te sê dat jy jou eie eerste boek, genaamd Set the Workers Free, wat in 1993 verskyn het, sê jy in die huidige boek wat ons vanoggend bespreek, it was regarded as real lunatic fringe. Jy beskryf jouself as contrarian en jy haal voormalige regte president John Meiburg aan by die bekendstelling van jou tweede boek, Liberating South African Labour from the Law, in 1999, hy het gesê, this is the most politically incorrect book I've ever read. So, ek wil begin, kom ons begin sommer Frans, deur te vra, wat het geword van die eerste twee boeke, van hulle leerstellings, en hoe kom jy by die derde boek uit?
Ja, Edwin, as jy my oomlik sal gee, ek wil net sê, hoekom is Edwin hier so vanmorgen? Hy mag dink is vanzelfsprekend. Ek het vanoggend vir iemand gesê, the worst of times and the best of times, ek kon nie een beter gespreksgenoot gekies het nie. Edwin het my ontmoet 200 meter van hier af in Wilgenhof se kwad. My eerste indruk van hom was dat hy al die eerste jaar sy name onthou het met een verbyloopslag. Edwin was deur die jare vir my een morele riglyn. Ons het nie altyd samengestem nie, en julle sal dalk agterkom vandag, ons stem nog steeds nie oor alles saam nie. Maar hy was nog altyd een riglyn en een rolmodel, en terselfdertyd dink ek een van die mees waardige opponente in het debat. So, daai kombinasie was onweerstaanbaar, en ek is baie bly dat hy hier is.
Baie dankie Frans, selfs in die vernederende omstandighede van die Wilgenhof dood.
Selfs in daai omstandighede, want hy het op die mooiste manier ingevryf, hy stap deur, dan groet hy al 69 eerstejaars, dan kom hy weer verby, dan het hy van elkeen een storiekie, wat hy onthou en dis korrek. Dit is so pijnlik, jy wil doodgaan.
Well, Frans, met jou was het makkelijk geweest. Frans, sy vader was op daardie stadium een van die bekendste mense in hele Suid-Afrika, Vanus Ruitenbach. En hy het deurgeloof in Wilgenhof. Ons het hom nooit vergewe dat sy pa so bekend en so nou vermaard was nie.
Nou om terug te kom na jou vraag toe, dis 'n gepaste noot. Ek het eintlik 'n behoefte gehad om my eie persoonlikheid te vestig. Ek was toe, noem het maar 'n maverick. Ek is vandag in 'n mate nog. Jy sal wel vind dat ek deurgaans in die boek 'n stryd met myself voer, en veral in die inleiding, wat ek sê, ek is die type mens wat, ek kan nie morele meerderwaardigheid verdra nie. As iemand vir my skynheiligheid voorhou, dan het ek hierdie onweerstaanbare drang om van sy voetstuk af te trek. En ek moet vreeslik waak daarteen, want dit is 'n persoonlikheidskenmerk, en dit mag jou daar verlei om in 'n argument in te gaan. En daarom is dit verskriklik belangrik om altyd te probeer om te toets, en selfs dan kry mens dit nie altyd reg nie. Maar die boek was die begin, omdat ek voor jou in arbeidsreg opgetree het, ons het gereeld arbitrasies gehou in die ou IMSA gebou in Auckland Park.
En daar's 'n voetnota daar, by the way Frans, mevrou Maxakata. Ja? Ons sal die voetnota ander tyd, een van die arbitrasies wat Frans voor my het, mevrou Maxakata van die Checkers.
Dit maak my nou bang. Ja. Dit maak my nou bang. Nie dat hy dit sê nie, maar dat hy dit onthou. Maar ja, ek onthou die Checkers arbitrasie.
Ja, en dit was 'n ou oomie, 'n toesighouer, wat teen haar getuig het. Anyway, ons sal nou nie die gehoor bemoei met daardie besonderhede.
Te veel familiegeheim uitlaat. En toe met die wat ek nou stap om aan mense nou maar uit die arbitrasie uit, en elke dag, dan sê ek vir myself, wat het ons nou vandag bereik? En omdat ek vir beide werkgevers en werknemers opgetree het, was daar geleidelike daar frustrasie in my opgebouw. Ek voel dat die stelsel werk nie optimaal om samenwerking te bevorder. En so het gekom dat ek eers toe weg is uit die balie uit, nadat ek die boek geskryf het, sê toe ook sê wat 'n beleidsaanval was op die
wet. Dis 25 jaar terug.
Dis 1993, ja. En die tweede boek was een soortgelijk een, maar is geskryf oor die nieuwe wet. En toe het ek vir 'n tyd lang werkswinkels gehou vir maatskappy, want ek het geglo, op die mikrovlak, moet dit moontlik wees om dit beter te maak. As jy in 'n maatskappy is, moet jy 'n samewerkingsmodel. Ek was voordat ons wet werkplek forums gehad het, waarvan ek tot vandag toe nog nie gesien het dat daar een in die praktyk geïmplementeer word nie, het ek gewerk aan so iets. Jy weet, dan sit jy en dan beraadslag jy nou met die vakbonde en die werkgewer en die werknemers en dan probeer jy nou. So het ek nou maar geworstel met die samewerkingsmodel om te kyk. En uiteindelik het ek toe nou besluit maar, miskien is die ekonomie belangrik, die strukture. En die boek het toe daar uitgekom, want ek het toe besluit, maar jy kan nie net na die arbeidsreg nie, dit lê baie groter voor die hand liggende ding is opvoeding. Opvoeding is so belangrik, dat ons kan nie daar sonder nie. En op die manier het ek toe nou besluit, maar hoewel jy sal oplet dat werk skepping nog steeds in die sentrale faktor is, ek dink ons stem saam dat het een belangrike probleem is, het ek na die groter ekonomie ook. So dis hoe die een uit die ander gevloei.
Kan ek jou net 'n opvolgvraag vra, Frans? Die leerstellings wat jy verkondig het in die eerste twee boeke, 25 jaar terug en amper 20 jaar terug, het jy enigszins aan hulle, by hulle aangepas of van hulle aangepas of van hulle afgewyk?
Baie aangepas. Ek het die
daar val hy in die lokval sommer in die eerste 10 minute, dames en heren.
Glad nie. Een van die beskuldigings wat jy baie maklik in my kon gemaak het, is dat ek ideoloog is wat nooit my standpunt verander nie. So,
daar red hy homself, of hy dink so.
jy sal sien in die eerste hoofstuk het ek 'n paar voorbeelde. Een voorbeeld betrek jou. Ek maak die punt vandag met die wysheid van Trukblikdak tot my skaamte, dat daar 'n tyd was wat ek gesê het, maar hierdie HIV vigs hypothese moet onder die vergrootglas geplaas word, maar dis my geaardheid. Ek bekyk alles, ek ondersoek die getuienis wat ek kry en dan maak ek gevolgtrek. Tot my redding moet ek sê dat ek redelik gou die lig gesien het.
Mag ek net intree, Frans, anders as jou beginselbondgenoot Leon Lou, wat aktief vir president Mbeki se vigs ontkenning denialism ondersteun het. Maar dis een vierkante haakie.
Dis een klein hoofstukkie.
Ja.
Ek sê maar net, toe wat gebeur, om nou jou vraag te antwoord, is, ek het toe redelik sterk geglo, maar die gebrek aan, of die oormaat van arbeidsregulasie lei tot werkloosheid. Dit was my hypothese geweest. Maar, ek loop my toe vas in een paar lande daar in Noord- en West-Europa. Noorwee, Swede, Duitsland, Holland. En dit raak toe ernstige probleem, want die lande het uit die aard van die saak een hoë vlak van arbeidsregulasie.
Dis teenvoorbeelde.
Ja, teenvoorbeelde. Hulle het hoë vlak van arbeidsregulasie en hulle het laag werkloosheid. En hulle het laag stakings. Nou wat nou? En ek het werkelijk moes stoei met die ding, want ek wou dit opklaar. Ek bedoel, hoe werk dit dan? Die gevolgtrekking wat ek toegekom het, waartoe ek toegekom het, is dat daar twee faktore is wat relevant is. Die ene is die diversiteit van die samelewing en die ander is die sentraliteit van die arbeidsbedeling. Wat ek daarmee bedoel is, as jy alles op 'n sentrale vlak beding, is dit baie makliker as jy jou homogene samelewing het, waar mense dieselfde opvoedingspeil, dieselfde inkomste vlakke, dieselfde etnise en kulturele agtergrond het, hulle verstaan mekaar gewoon beter. Dis 'n feit soos 'n koei. Edwin, I have just noticed a very good friend of mine who is an Icelander has moved into the room. With your permission, shall we perhaps
change to
veer English. Over to English?
Please don't feel embarrassed about arriving 10 minutes late. We're going to repeat everything we've said in English for you.
I don't have many arguments, so like a good advocate, I'll repeat them countless times.
Yeah.
So what happened was that I realized that I had to find an answer for this phenomenon, which is also an Icelandic one, that homogeneity of the society seems to work in a centralized system, or centralization in a homogenous society, but not in a diverse society. The diverse society are typically your Anglo-American society. and United States, the UK, Australia, Singapore, and then also a few others like Switzerland. And they very successfully implement a decentralized system. And that's...
Which is one of your chapters.
That's one of my chapters. In fact, it's in a section of the book as well. Is that there's a theme of decentralization, the second half of the book, which I believe is I honestly believe we missed the trick. We have a fantastic constitution, but I wish, and I, you know, blame myself to that extent as well. We didn't see it coming. We were so happy to get a settlement in 1994 and so on, that we possibly overlooked things which, on with retrospect, the wisdom of hindsight, appeared to be things that we could have done slightly better.
Frans, that allows me to ask one of my central questions towards you, which is that you have a theoretical model with a lot of statistical support, which you cull from various American think tanks and so on, in order to liberalize the market, the economy, to create jobs, to create a greater productivity. My point is a simple one, which is that you seem in your book to disregard the fact that we are all prisoners of our history. And if you look at the way Afrikaner history of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, until recently, was itself a product of the Anglo-Boer War and the grief and the resentments that arose from it and the sense of inferiority. You speak about black pain. You've got quite a section about this phenomenon of black pain where the angry young people on our campuses say, you don't understand black pain. And you say that's like a childish tantrum. But would you say the same to those Afrikaner leaders? I went to Afrikaans schools where ons sien haar wen, die standbeeldjie. Wie was in 'n laerskool waar die standbeeldjie ons sien haar wen was? U moes daar gewees het. Ons was almal daar. In the memory of the Boer War in the 1960s, it was only 60 years away. So let me make my point, Frans, which is that the abstractions of the free market have got to find location in the reality of political blood and guts and grime. And do you take enough account of that?
All right. Let me say, and you've already alluded to it, is I start out the book with a reference to the history. I put the very elephant in the room of race up front, right in the middle. It is obviously a major issue. It's a major problem, and I acknowledge the historical difficulty which brought us where we are, and it is a terrible history. There is absolutely no question. I absolutely agree with you in terms of the blood and the guts spilled.
Let me quickly intrude a square bracket, and then I'm going to give you a chance to complete it. For example, the labor laws. You would liberalize labor law where the dismissal by a white boss of a black worker isn't simply an act of employment termination. It is a conjuring, a reenactment, a regurgitation of 350 years of racial subordination. So that's the practical difficulty, that you're dealing with a human setting in which you can't simply liberalize the labor law because it will give rise to terrible conflict.
My concern, there's a lovely chapter, just to give this background.
You must. We are instructing our audience, and they're all going to buy the book afterwards.
I hope so.
Is that correct, dames en heren?
Yeah.
I'll say.
Let me just say, in your book, which is in the blurb, Witness to AIDS, which is a wonderful book. I hope this is available. I don't know. But I enjoyed this. It's gut-wrenching, I have to tell you. I found it a very personal experience to read the book, because it's really well written from that perspective. And what Edwin reminds me of is precisely the point you're making now, that this clinical economy that I impose must be tempered with the empathy of pain. One has to find that balance somewhere. At the same time, I drive past the townships. I drive past the easiest one for my friend Samuel over there. So you drive from the airport to Cape Town and you see the little shanty towns. And I know that is the result primarily of, yes, apartheid, yes, lack of education, but as we sit here, unemployment. And that unemployment has been growing hand over fist. I don't know that there has been a middle-income country in recent history which has had such an impressive record of unemployment.
Increased unemployment.
Increased unemployment.
Officially round about 26%.
Yes, 26, 27, that's the narrower definition, otherwise about 36%. And we're talking about, if you look the wider definition, 9 million people. Now that is guts and glory and pain. That is really,
To persuade people to your solutions, you have to take all of that into account. Yeah. And my challenge to you is that I don't think you do it sufficiently.
Mm-hmm. I believe how we persuade people is obviously important. We have to work every day on how to persuade. My aim was to say, what do I think will work? And remember, you raised the issue of persuasion, and I acknowledge in the very last chapter
advocacy issue.
The art of the possible. How do I do this?
And
it is
change.
Immense difficulty, and I understand most of the chapters I end, it will be a battle to the death to try and, because we know how painful it is and how many historical forces there are pulling people apart. So we have to find a way. And I thought very deeply about that. And the only way I ultimately see, and it is that I make the point, what got us where we are is experience. It's the experience of pain of black people and the false illusion of prosperity on the white side. That's what got us where we are. How do we change that?
Well, we have the reality of pain, but we have the specter, the onlooklichkeit, the attraction of a remedy. So you've got reality and remedy.
Yes.
Let me go back a few steps and bring you very kindly and generously mentioned my book, Frans. I've been perverse, overrechts, about three things in my life. The one was racial politics in the 80s, to which I came late. When I was in Stellenbosch, I'm not proud of my political profile at Stellenbosch at all. I wasn't an outsider.
You did okay.
You know, many for my help, nie, ons los het net daar. Ek kon veel meer gedoen het. I came belatedly to it. The second, Frans, was my own homosexuality and the equality, the rights to equality of LGBTI people. The third was AIDS. They were all difficult issues. The least difficult one for me was the racial issue, because when I got back from Oxford, finally, I was committed to a human rights law practice. What was happening seemed very grievous and gross to me. With homosexuality, I knew from my very soul that I'd been born like this. For 30 years, I'd struggled to deny the fact that I was not the same as most other people. It was completely self-evident, and to almost every LGBTI person that you meet, most of them will say that they were born like this or that it became evident to them. We are as unchangeably same-sex oriented, to the extent that each of us is, as most people are opposite-sex oriented. So there wasn't, I'm talking about empiricism, by the way, you'll see where I'm coming to. The third one, and the most interesting one, and the one that still has resonance, is AIDS.
Mm.
Where you have a catastrophic epidemic that first affects homosexual men overwhelmingly in North America, Western Europe, and Australasia. It comes to Africa, evident by the mid-1980s, and the epidemiological profile is utterly different. So Mbeki comes in with his enticing but catastrophically wrong propositions. Mm. By the time he started his denialism, I had been on antiretroviral therapy for 2 years. I started
it. You already knew it worked.
I knew it worked. I knew that my life had been saved. I was desperately sick in 1997. By the end of 1999, when he started, I knew that my life had been prolonged. It's now 20 years later, by the way.
Mm.
But Franz, the point is really about empiricism. You're dealing with a reality of grief and history. Your remedy is a set of abstractions and propositions. How do you prove?
Marry them.
Well, you've got to marry them, but you've also got to show that we've got to take the risk of dismantling the labor protections, dismantling the market protections, curbing the state. These are massive, massive political and constitutional events. You concede that the Constitution will have to be amended. So you're asking us to take a massive risk on empirically unfounded propositions. That's my challenge.
You say unfounded as far as the populace who are affected by it.
Well, as far as the certainty that they will produce
the
beneficial effects that you propound.
But I must tell you, I have to thank you for that question because you perhaps know where I'm leading since you presumably read the whole book.
I promise you I did. You can check every page.
But it's a very useful question. Because I deal with this whole topic of persuasion at the end of the book. And I come back to what I said, the only way to change one's views. You know, there's Hoffman, the writer on the law of evidence, makes a wonderful statement at one point. He says, we still have to invent an accurate way of measuring the certainty of human belief. How do we really know what we believe? I believe ultimately you're quite right. It's empiricism, it's experience. Now, just to give you one very personal example, one of the most important things that gave me certainty about the AIDS debate was the day you said you started taking antiretrovirals. I thought, well, that removes all doubt. Because I know the man and I can see the results.
President Mbeki also knew me, but it didn't convince him.
Well, to me, that was absolutely decisive. I couldn't, you know. All right.
But Franz, a quick square bracket. You're also a climate skeptic.
I am.
You want to kill all the whales and the seals.
No.
You want to feed plastic into the seas.
No.
I'm sitting here on stage with you. Admit that those are things you want to do.
No. There's another book which deals with the Kruger Park. Yes, that's my friend Peter Rui knows I'm an avid nature lover. The chapter of your last chapter is poignantly called, very cleverly called, Choices. And it deals with two kinds of choices. You tell, if you'll excuse me, the terrible choices you made and people made when you were young, and the tragic choice of your sister crossing the traffic light against the red light and tragically dying in an accident. But also there's the choices of policy. And we always have to weigh up when we make those policy choices. And you very powerfully illustrate that you can't have it all. I think you convinced me of that. All right, can I get back to the persuasion and empiricism argument? For me, the best idea that I have come up with is there's a speech that was made by Deng Xiaoping when he wanted to change China.
1978.
And he took the brave step. Now, he didn't have the little niggling problem of democracy to contend with.
And the Constitution.
I readily concede all of that. But Deng Xiaoping said, this thing which seems to be creating a measure of prosperity across our borders, on the other side, in Hong Kong, which was really very, very close. Maybe we should try it. And the image that he used, I really loved, was to say we must cross the river feeling the stones one at a time. And what he said is something which reminded me of what Cyril Ramaphosa recently and frequently said. Ray Hartley in his book points out that Cyril Ramaphosa makes use of the term a beachhead. You must stake your claim a little bit at a time. Now, what I'm saying is, if it could be possible, and I know there are constitutional constraints, but I see the possibility that we start feeling the stones carefully one at a time. In other words, let's create small experimental, call them zones, call them projects, where we don't have to do everything at once. I have in mind, for example, a schools project, which has got a certain implications. I have in mind a housing project, which has certain implications. But they all
you want to try. Stop government-funded housing and give it over to private enterprise.
I basically want to stop government-funded housing. And I'm not alone. There have been ministers who echoed that sentiment. I would like to see...
Well, you quote Lindiwe Sisulu,
yes,
who says people must stop expecting houses.
Yes. I'm not necessarily saying that is the be-all and end-all of all authority. I'm simply saying, and I think there are others. But let's explain what I have in mind. I foresee the possibility that there are, in an area, homeless people. No money, no income, no jobs. And possibly, in many cases, no social grants. I cannot see any reason, in fairness, why people in that situation cannot be employed by a private construction entrepreneur free from the current constraints of labor law and other laws. I think I also foresee the bureaucratic red tape being
would you abolish workmen's compensation? Unemployment insurance? Is onder die versoeking. Ek plaas hom so onder die versoeking.
Hy
vroeg.
Do you know what I would like to see? My answer to that is, and I know you're going to say to me it's a distinction without a difference. I don't think it is. Section 5 of the Labor Relations Act and Section 5 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act both say you cannot contract out of the law. I would like to see, for very limited purposes, those sections scrapped. In other words, let the party sort out what you contract out of. And because it's still better, I think, and this is maybe where your choices come. We can't have it all. You can't have that person building a house and living in a house and having a career and having labor laws applicable for him.
The real difficulty, you say let the parties. The parties in your abstraction are two mythical sides. In the reality, it will be an employer with a lot of capital and a bucky and a lot of power, and it will be someone who's got nothing.
Mm.
Those are the two parties.
Absolutely.
So that's the risk.
What you're talking about is the difference in bargaining power.
And agency.
In economic strength.
Correct. And human power.
Edwin, there is nobody with as weak a bargaining position as the unemployed. Absolutely nobody. And that is where my, call it, relative moral certainty comes from. Nobody is as miserable as somebody who cannot command a job. That's where the weakness comes. You are so weak in your impotence because you don't have a job. And that's the poorest of the poor has a meaning. And to me, it is that person who is absolutely too uneducated. Historically, if you understand what I'm saying, too black by reason of the disadvantages coming with that. And possibly female. And, as I said, untrained to command a job. Whereas if we give that person an opportunity to enter a housing project where you will learn basic skills, building skills, carpentry, and this can become a longer-term project where you will continue working for the same employer, and because of the simplification of the regulatory structure, you can do it more cheaply. And what do? You solve... start solving a housing problem and you start solving this wealth creation unemployment problem in one go. I just can't see from a, you know, a moral perspective why that is a bad
let's
idea.
Let's go back to the other end, Frans. You aren't a free market nut.
No, I'm not. I'm not a nut.
It's a concession I'm willing to make. No, I agree.
I'm prepared to make the concession that I make it several times. That I call myself a libertarian, but even I have to concede there are manifest roles for the state.
Central bank. Police force. Army. Traffic. You concede all of those. So,
cross examination.
Exactly. But it's an important point, Frans, because two of the most influential commentators who I read in Business Day and Financial Mail are Peter Bruce and Tim Cohn. And they propound some of your propositions, but much more modestly. So, what is the difference?
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, you protect yourself by saying we've got to have a beachhead, but they don't embrace the ideological structure that you are in fact pursuing.
Mm. It's an extremely difficult question. I can be glib and say you need the intervention of the state insofar as it protects the freedom, but really. Is that really going to assist us? I'm not sure it is.
Sorry for interrupting you. What do you say to someone that says your father, Farnes Rotenbach, was benefited in the 1930s by the biggest, this is what Saint-Pieter Blanche used to say, the grootste oordrag van
rechtstellende actie.
Rechtstellende actie, the greatest transfer of state assets in 20th century state was to the Afrikaner in the 1930s and 40s.
Mm.
What do you say to a black person who says, you benefited from that, your sons, whom you mentioned in the first chapter of the book, I benefited from it. Now you want to stop all of that.
Mm.
Doesn't that reek of utterly unacceptable injustice?
What reeks of injustice is what has been happening in the last 20, 30 years. To me, I do think I have some evidence on my side for saying that we have been digging a hole and we must not think if we keep on digging the hole, we're going to get out of it. And that is the concern that I have. I think, to me, that also reeks of injustice. There is no perfect moral symmetry here. It's impossible. I honestly tried to sort out the moral symmetry of the especially the employment equity or affirmative action argument. I don't think it's possible. And difficulty is this. If you look at the curve of the incomes, the most remarkable thing is that post-1994, white income soared compared to average black income. To me, that is a sad state of affairs. It should have been the other way around. What the project that you're talking about should have gone the other way. And we know, as we sit here, if you have a full-scale transfer of wealth from now the minority white to the majority black, that will be an economic and a moral catastrophe.
I think we must make an important distinction that wealth transfers on their own can be catastrophic. We saw what happened in Zimbabwe where the land was taken. There's a general consensus, even amongst the political elite in South Africa that's now adopted the idea of amending the constitution, that the Zimbabwe-style wealth transfer cannot happen. But the question is not whether you're going to take wealth away from the current whites, but how you're going to use government action. The real debate is not about wealth accumulation, historical wealth accumulation. That's part of the debate. The real debate is how are you going to use government power? And you want to reduce government power at the very time that I certainly think the government power is indispensable.
Edwin, there is no government power that is not money. Government power is money. So
rent.
You can rent. You can dress it up any way you like. Ultimately, when you reduce government power, you reduce the amount of taxpayers' money that is being spent. That's basically what it boils down to. A graph which is not in the book. Forgive me for, because I have to look somewhere for evidence. I compared our peers, 24 of our peers, in terms of state spending. There's
middle-income countries.
Middle-income countries, the 12 above us and the 12 below us. So, fair sample. The only one that spends more than us by way of state consumption spending in that list is Namibia. Guess which country has more unemployment than South Africa? Namibia. My difficulty is there are choices, and there is no choice like that that does not have consequences. And the statistics show bigger state power, which translates to bigger state spending, higher unemployment. It is almost a mathematical correlation.
Franz, I want to go back a few steps and just, it's a fascinating thing to say to a largely or exclusively white audience. Those figures are incontestable, that the white section of the population, it's true that something like 5 or 6, maybe 7% of whites now live in poverty. There are, the stories are exaggerated, but they are a bit blokkerskampe.
Absolutely.
We know that. But 95% of white families have in fact done very well.
Yes.
That has coincided with the fact that the civil service has become overwhelmingly black.
Yes.
So white people were constrained to start postnets, to start electrical engineering businesses.
Franchises,
whatever they did, and they thrived. Mm. So they've done very, very well.
Mm.
But they've managed to do that with the accumulated advantage of a century of pro-white affirmative action.
I have no doubt about that.
While we're agreeing, I call for your Ian Klopp here, and then I want to invite questions from the audience.
As long as I can klop back.
Ja, jy het een en wie het nog? Ja, jy moet terugklap. Frans, dis die volgende. Dis die ou debat which Martin Brassey started, which is, and you put it in a different way. Martin Brassey is a very famous labor lawyer who's a colleague of Frans. And the question he asked controversially was, can you speak about being disadvantaged? It's the Helen Ziller colonialism debate, and you actually venture on it.
I was before Helen.
Your book was at the printer before Helen.
But I tried to pull it, but I couldn't.
The basic emotional issue is whether there was any benefit from colonialism. Martin Brassey put it slightly differently. He said, how can you say that you were disadvantaged by colonialism or that you need affirmative action when if there'd never been any white settlement here at all, you might not have been as well off as you are now. So you've got to do a comparative exercise to say, well, although white people have done extremely well, black people have done a bit better because of the white presence here. It is a very loaded, contentious debate. The proposition, the clap I want to give to you is that your construct in the book, it leaves out of account that there could have been white settlement and colonialism without the degradation and the injustice and the subordination and the indignities of colonialism.
I disagree. I discuss that scenario expressly. Mm. And what I say is, if we had done what we were supposed to do, let us say we started here, we arrived here, we colonized, but we had no discrimination, we had, call it a liberal dispensation. What would have happened? And I say, I know it's almost impossible because we're speculating, but on the probabilities, I say what would have happened is that we would have had more black people going to school, more black people with businesses very early on, which would have meant that we would have had better productivity amongst the black community, which we could have employed as white people, which black people could have employed as black entrepreneurs, and we would have had bigger markets into which to sell. So the point I'm making is that would have meant that white people would have been better off. There's no profit in discrimination. It was a terrible travesty, not only to the black people, but we did ourselves a huge disfavor.
The tragedy, speaking of our choices, is that we had that option with the National Convention in 1909. And Britain, because of the burdened history of the Boer War, stood back and let the Boer liberals, Boertaan Smuts and the others, negotiate with the English establishment to exclude black franchise, except on a very limited basis in the Cape, which was a great tragedy. Dames en heren, ons is nou drie kwartier in ons gesprekken. We welcome your questions. I've located one question, and we're going to take other questions from the audience. Where do I recognize anyone else who wants to ask? Meneer, for you.
Names, maybe?
Yeah, please, if you identify yourself.
Goeiemôre, my naam is Enrico Knussen en ek het 'n vraag of ons nie in die gesprek die olifant in die kamer mis nie. Ek wil graag die volgende vraag vra. Hoeveel onwettige immigrante is daar vandag in Suid-Afrika? En hoeveel immigrante is daar van ander Afrika lande in Suid-Afrika? En sou ons so onmenslik wou wees, is net 'n hipotetiese vraag, om al daai immigrante terug te stuur? What's the impact of it on our werkloosheid?
Samuel, should we send back approximately estimates 3 to 5 million cross-border migrants, whom Enrico calls illegal immigrants, and would that not have a beneficial effect on the nation and the economy? Frans, I wait with anticipation for your answer.
Can I speak English? Jammer, jy verstaan. I think it would be a bad idea because it will probably harm our economy.
I think, France, by the way, we agree on that.
Yeah.
I think that cross-border migrancy in Europe, in North America, helps the economy.
Yeah.
And the history of the last 200-300 years also shows that import tariffs, like Trump in America wants to impose, have been a catastrophe for economic development.
Ladies and gentlemen, my free market colleague, former Justice.
May I say that we are talking about international tariffs. And I see international tariffs as being exactly analogous to cross-border prohibitions on human migration.
I agree absolutely.
We agree on that.
I think that...
Without conceding the ideological underpinnings.
No, I believe that the problem is there should be more free markets. Let me just make this clear. Ideally, the SADC, the South African, is that the right thing?
DC, the SADC.
Yeah, SADC.
Development Community.
SADC, our local trade area, should all be a free market area. That would have been even better.
And a single passport.
Because I hate the idea that if you go to Diepsloot, which is an informal settlement outside of Johannesburg, I think the figure is 48% of the entrepreneurs are foreigners, whereas only 19% of the population are immigrants. So there's a disproportionate amount of initiative and entrepreneurship amongst them, which I, of course, ascribe partly to the fact that they have no choice.
It's called the migrancy imperative.
Yes.
You arrive in London or in Sydney or wherever, you've got to work extra hard. And every Zimbabwean here has got to work extra hard.
Yes. And he does not get the benefits. The benefits that we didn't touch on that, but that's a difficult
thing. I'll let you off. France says that social grants, which the 18 million social grants benefiting 12 million people, he says they are a form of morally noxious and unacceptable rent seeking.
let me just say, I identify a difficulty, because this is why the Diepsloot example is important. And that's not the only evidence, but there's a puzzlingly low level of entrepreneurship in South Africa at all levels, but also at the very lowest level. Whereas you look north of our borders where they do not have, they can't afford social grants and other forms of welfare to all practical intents and purposes, you will find vastly higher levels. I always use the example of Uganda, where I consulted a few years ago, and I arrived on a 12 o'clock on a Sunday night, and I traveled from the airport to town. And all along the road, there were stalls of people welding, making, fixing cars, doing hairdressing, washing dogs, etc. So it's the most entrepreneurial country in terms of the global entrepreneurship monitor. A desperately poor country with a terrible history, as we know. If anything, a more
and
bloody
a terrible
history.
Autocrat, the longest autocrat, longest in power.
And yet a spirit of entrepreneurship, which you have to admire, with very little state support. And I personally say, it's not in spite of the lack of state support. I think there is something in the human spirit which says, if I really have to, because I'm not given a crutch, I can do it.
Would, and you, that abolish, is really, would you abolish social grants?
I would phase them out. I think if we say tomorrow we have to scrap all social grants, I you can just imagine the social pain that would be caused. I think we must design a way. I spoke about the housing project earlier. I say, for example, if somebody signs up for the housing project where he becomes an employee under that dispensation, he waives, I'm assuming he has a social grant, he waives it. In other words, you phase it out. You give him an alternative. The other way is work fair, where you say, on condition that you can actually demonstrate you're looking for a job. In South Africa, we know it's very difficult to find a job. So I'm not so convinced of that one. The other one is the
state. Thoughts on the fact that people experience work fear as very humiliating.
Yes, it's sort of, it goes against my gut, because I love the dignity of freedom of choice. And that to me, it's almost like the IMF coming in and telling us, this is how you have to run your economy. Do this, do this, do this. It's humiliating. So I'm not very, very fond of that one. The other possibility is we give parcels of land. You marry the two crises. The one is the land difficulty. We sit with millions of hectares of state land. Why don't we, and we can decide about the size, but why don't we give a parcel of land to somebody, but then pari passu, we exchange that for the welfare, because that's giving somebody a start. You give him a fishing rod rather than a fish every day.
Nog vrae, dames en here, more questions. Yes, sir. Ma'am? Yes, the person there? Yes, sir. Johan, just re-identify yourself.
I'm
Thank
Johan
you.
Johan Slazes. And Einstein used to say, insanity is to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. Now, we've had a government in power for the past 22, 23 years with a very much centralized, controlled economy. And we can see the result of it is rising unemployment, decreasing income for the black population, and rising state expenditure. Haven't we reached a stage where this very well labor laws must be tweaked? I don't say abolished, and that's where I support the speaker, that we should perhaps firstly look at tweaking the labor laws to try and get a different result, because we haven't been successful up to now. And then secondly, with the new president that we have and his background of the economy, is there chances, or are there chances that this may happen?
I think, funnily enough, there is a chance. I looked at, as I said, I've just finished reading it's not a biography, it's a book by Ray Hartley, the former Sunday Times editor, who wrote about Ramaphosa's potential presidency. In fact, he had his discussion here, and the point that was made is it's the best timed book in the history of South African publishing. It came out all virtually on the eve of the NEC election, and all his bets came through. He won that election and he ultimately became the president. And I have since been wrestling with this question because I say to myself, where do I, as a potential reformer now, go? Do I go to the DA or do I go to Mr. Ramaphosa or do I go somewhere else?
Or the EFF.
Yes, the Economic Freedom Fighters. I think that's the closest I'll get to Salvation, is that the name has to deal with economic and freedom. And my reading of Mr. Ramaphosa, I may regret this later, but my reading of him is that he is an extremely ambitious man. He's an extremely practical and extremely efficient organizer and negotiator.
And extremely competent.
And he's really competent. I mean, his record is... I know we tend to... I always try and avoid this. Let's not even say black. The best negotiator that we probably have in this country. The most effective negotiator. But the mystery is he an ideologue? Does he really believe? Remember, he was the founder of the NUM, and he was the person who took the NUM from the Black Consciousness Movement across into the ANC camp. Does he passionately believe in the underlying ideology of labor legislation, or has he never believed it, or maybe did his business experience and exposure give him a far more nuanced vision? I'm hoping that he's a pragmatist.
Mr. Ramaphosa was in charge of the NEDLAC negotiations that led to the package of labor law reforms that included the strike ballot, which is seen by many people as pivotal.
As a liberalizing
influence.
Well, there's a glimpse.
Frans, I want to see if there are any more questions. Yes, right at the back. Let me ask you something, Frans, and then I'm going to give, is it a gentleman at the back? Yes, please. The chance to ask the final question, because we're almost on 10 o'clock. I'm troubled by the fact that you're a climate change skeptic, Frans. I'm deeply troubled. I really am. It worries me because Frans and I have known each other since 1975. Is that when you first persevered, Volkanov?
76. You okay. Were just the ex prim.
Ek was toe net afgestaan as primaries. Ek het jou nie te min gedoop.
Ja, jy was daar country member.
Tot my groot genot. Frans, The analogy between the science of AIDS and the inferences from the epidemiological patterns of AIDS and climate change are very similar. Very, very similar. In both cases, you have weighty empirical evidence that suggests that man-made interventions are creating an imminent crisis, which may be an imminent catastrophe of climate change. The same occurred with AIDS. You have repented of AIDS. You've given my personal testimony a role in that. And I beg of you, before we take the last question, to repent of your climate change skepticism.
Can I implore you similarly? And I mean this. Bring a comprehensive set of evidence and argument, which is coherent, which makes sense. Let me just give you one example. It's circumstantial evidence at the moment. There's no direct evidence. Nobody can observe.
Like with AIDS.
Yes.
Like with AIDS.
As with AIDS. Now, from the serious change in climate occurred after 1945. A serious uptick in CO2 because of the industrial difference.
And in global warming.
Yes. And in global warming.
And in particular since 2000.
But from 45 to 75, the actual temperature record shows a decline. It actually declined. And then secondly, in 97 to 2015, there was a flat line. Now, you can explain that in many ways.
And the scientists do.
Well, Frans, that's my difficulty.
Voordat ek in trane uitbars. Kan ons daardie man asseblief vra? So, last question and then we're going to wrap up. Please identify yourself, sir.
Hello, I'm Or Groeneveld and I'm a civil contractor. So my question is about the construction. which I like the example that you brought up. We've got a huge problem with entry-level rates, entry-level labor rates that we have to pay. And I think it's one of those industries in South Africa, it's a prime example, where everyone's losing out. We're losing out on skills. We're losing out on skills that we can export to other countries. And we now, as Enrico is saying, we're now sitting with a lot of foreigners coming in and taking over those jobs. We're falling back onto labor brokers. Everything is just wrong about it. What are your views on that specific, and where should we appeal for that? And maybe you've seen something in Tanzania, Kenya, etc. that you can offer.
Franz, a last answer and a wrap up.
Yes, I think by now it should not be a surprise that I tend to be sympathetic towards that difficulty. The difficulty is that such a vast majority of our workforce are currently, and for the foreseeable, possibly decades, will be uneducated and untrained. How do we get them into the workplace? There are some industries where this has been demonstrated very graphically. If you impose minimum terms and conditions, which simply puts it out of reach, that the employee cannot command a job. We deny him that opportunity of getting in the door and learning and working his way up. Edwin, I have to thank you enormously for your kindness of being here and the gentle treatment that I've received at your hands.
Low bottom.
I'll send you my climate change spiel.
Which will definitely trigger tears.
And I will... Yes. No. Please, don't get all sensitive and blubbery on me. I know you're tough. Send me an answer and we'll take it further. Because at the moment, I'm just that. There's a difference between a skeptic and a denialist.
I agree with that. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we are indebted to Franz for writing a provocative book. Thank you for your presence. May we give him a round of applause. Baie dankie, dames en here.
Dankie, Edwin. Het groot plezier, Frans.